Faith and Persistence, the third talk in a series entitled Prayer and Perseverance, was presented by Ron Julian on September 3, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
If you have been here for the last couple of weeks, you know that I have asked the indulgence of the community here in letting me teach through the material that I've been writing my thesis on. I've been writing on two parables, the parable of the friend at midnight and the parable of the unjust judge. And in the last 2 weeks, we talked about those two parables. So anyway, today I'm going to take some other material from my thesis that to supplement the discussion of prayer that has been the issue that has been raised by these two parables, and I will talk about that this week, and I will have some more things to say about this next week. It turns out I'm teaching next week as well, so the next week will be the last of it. Let me point out by something striking in both of the parables of the friend at midnight and the unjust judge, which are the two parables that we've been talking about. Both of them teach about prayer, but the striking thing about both of them is that they say that the answer to these prayers will always and inevitably be yes, that ultimately in asking for these things that are talked about in these two parables, the assurance is God is going to say yes, ultimately. And the friend at midnight, we're told that just as it is unimaginable that the friend would say no, so it is unimaginable that God would say no. And then the story is, in fact, followed by the famous assurances that if we ask, we will receive, if we knock, the door will be opened, and so on. Likewise, in the parable of the unjust judge, we are told that God will certainly answer the cries of his elect speedily. So, how are we to deal with this blanket assurance that the answer is yes? How are we to think about prayer in the light of those things? It seems to me that there are a couple options. First of all, Jesus might be exaggerating, speaking in hyperbole. He doesn't really mean that the answer is surely going to be yes. But I think this is very unlikely. I mean, the whole point of these stories, both of them hinge on this idea that it is unthinkable that God would say yes. It's unthinkable that the person in the story would say yes, and God is even more likely to say yes. So that doesn't seem to work. Jesus might be saying then that God will, in fact, say yes to any request we might make, anything and everything that we ask for, if we believe we're going to get it or if we persist in asking long enough, then we will get what we asked for. Well, I've argued that that's not what those parables are in fact teaching, and I think this is very unlikely in general. For one thing, the Bible has many examples of prayers for which the answer was no. We can see that the heroes of the Bible made requests of God that God said, no, I'm not going to do that. This includes Jesus' own prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane that the cup might pass from him. And in fact, the cup did not pass from him. So, our third option then is that Jesus might be actually speaking of a particular kind of prayer. Not every prayer will always receive the answer yes, but there are some kinds of prayer that certainly will always receive the answer yes. And I think, in fact, that's what's going on. And so, I want to talk a little bit about this distinction and the difference it makes in how we think about faith and prayer. There's an important difference between prayer for things that God has promised and prayer for specific things that I would like, but that God has not promised. Both kinds of prayer are legitimate. Both kinds of prayer are biblical, but they are different kinds of prayer, and that's what I want to talk about this morning. One more comment before I get started here. In Luke 11, Jesus makes a comparison between a father responding to his son and God responding to us. We are evil, and yet we know how to give good gifts to our children. How much more will God give good gifts, give the Holy Spirit, in fact, to those who ask? I think that one of the ways that the modern picture of prayer has gone wrong is that we have forgotten how much prayer is like the interaction between parents and children. I think Jesus' analogy there actually is a deep one. It applies to a very large extent. So I'm going to tell some stories this morning to kind of highlight that connection. So the topic this morning, what I want to highlight is, given what we've seen in those parables, I want to talk about, in general, the idea between the connection between faith and persistence in prayer. And I have three assertions to make this morning. And when I've made those assertions, then I'll be done. So, assertion number one. Faith means believing everything that God has promised and persisting in prayer until those promises are fulfilled. Let me say it again. Faith means believing everything that God has promised and persisting in prayer until those promises are fulfilled. That, I think, is one of the large messages that comes from the parables that we were looking at. This is the kind of persistence that Jesus was talking about in the parable of the unjust judge, for example. Well, Jesus told a story about a father responding to a son in the midst of making these points. So I have a father and son story of my own. Once there was a father who made a great promise to his two sons. One day, when each of them was ready, he would give them a large piece of his extensive property. Each one would receive his own property. Through the gift of this rich and fertile land, each son would become a wealthy and important landowner in his own right. The first son, whenever need would press him, would think of the promise of that land and ask his father if he could have it now. Each time he asked, the father would answer, "No, not yet." Many times the longing for that land led the son to ask, and many times he was disappointed in his request. Yet he never lost heart. He knew that his father's word was his bond and that one day he would receive what he had been promised. So whenever his need and desire filled his heart, he would go again to ask. And one day he heard the father say what he had been longing to hear, "Yes, it is time." The second son also was pressed by many needs and filled with desire for that land. He too went a number of times to ask his father for the land he had been promised. The second son, however, soon lost heart. "Each time I ask, I come away empty-handed. Why should I pin my hopes on a promise of land that may never arrive?" So one day the second son said to the father, "I am no longer your son," and left home to make his own fortune, a fortune that he never found. When the time came to give the first son his promised piece of land, the father gave him the second son's land as well, because the second son was nowhere to be found. Okay, well, let me make some points from my little story here. First of all, what's central to my story, I mean, it's pretty obvious what I'm doing, I think. The father promised that he would one day give that land. Well, God has promised many things to us. He has promised to forgive us for our many sins. He has promised to free us from death and give us eternal life. He has promised to bring justice and righteousness to the world. He has promised to sanctify us, to mature our faith, and to bring us into wisdom. And there are many other things that we could point to. These are promises that God has made. There is no question of "if it be your will." God has already made it clear that it is his will. Both of the two parables that we have been talking about tell us that God will certainly and without fail say yes when we ask him to fulfill the promises that he has made. In The Friend at Midnight, we see that God will certainly say yes even if we feel presumptuous and unworthy. In The Unjust Judge, we see that God will certainly say yes even if that yes seems a long time in coming. Well, what is the appropriate response to these promises then? We should do what the first son did. The first son kept going back. This is exactly how I understand the choice with which Jesus confronts us in the parable of the unjust judge. Like the sons in this story, like the widow in Jesus' story, we have promises from God that he will finally make all things right. Yet we continue to face suffering and unrighteousness in this life. When the pressure is on, we cannot ignore it. We must respond somehow. But will our response be to go again to the God that we know loves us and cares about what is right? Or will we abandon hope, cease to persevere in our belief in God's promises, and look to some other remedy? Jesus has made a strong connection between faith and persevering in prayer. He isn't saying that true faith will schedule a certain number of hours of prayer a day or something like that. He means that when the pressure is on, when we are hurting and longing for God's help, we have to decide how we are going to respond to the long periods when it seems like that help is not coming. We need to remember what God has promised and keep on trusting in him, which means, in part, to continue to go to him for the help that he has promised. The second son in my story stopped asking because he stopped expecting that his father would do anything. He had forgotten the character of his father. He had forgotten that the father does not make promises lightly. And we all know that this is not an easy or automatic thing. This is a part of the great struggle of the Christian life, that in the midst of our trials, we will continue to persevere in trusting in God and turning to him. But ultimately, that is what we're called to do. This concept of persistence in prayer is just an aspect of perseverance in faith. Either we're going to hang in there with God or we're not. Okay. So that's assertion number one, and that relates to what we have talked about in the last 2 weeks from the parables themselves. Assertion number two is going to take me beyond the parables that we talked about. Assertion number two is this: faith means trusting in God's goodness and persisting in taking our concerns to him. Okay, what I've said up to this point is when God has promised something, believers should continue to pray for that something with absolute certainty. Not everything that believers pray for, however, falls into the category of things promised by God. Financial hardships, relationship problems, health worries, death, these are all issues that press on us as believers. And yet God has made no promises that things will always turn out the way we want in these situations. Now, ultimately, of course, God has promised to solve all of these problems fully and completely. That's what the kingdom of God is all about, ultimately. God has promised eternal life with richness and health and love. Life will be satisfying in our relationships, in our relationship with God, in our experience of life altogether. There is no promise, however, that in this life, Bob will stop mistreating Carol, or that Fred will be healed of his fatal disease. And yet we greatly desire for God to solve these problems, and our prayers are often about these sorts of things. Now, you're probably aware that some Christians would take exception to what I've just said. They would argue that God has promised to solve any problem now, including healing any fatal diseases that may be around, if only we ask with enough faith and persistence. Well, there are two questionable ideas here. First of all, that God has promised to heal all diseases and solve all problems in this life. And secondly, that faith means being totally convinced that you will receive these things and persisting in asking until you get them. That first idea, that God has promised to heal all diseases, that takes us into the issue of the charismatic gifts and all of that kind of stuff, and that is not my topic this morning. Let me just say, I mean, I'm sure you know where I'm coming from on that issue, but let me just say that even among those who embrace a charismatic view of the faith, not everyone would say that God has promised that all diseases will be healed. Many who would have a higher view of the charismatic phenomena than I do would still argue that it is a question of the will of God. So we're not going to deal with that issue this morning. We can talk about that later if you want. But it's that second part that I'm interested in, the idea that faith means being totally convinced that you will receive whatever you ask for and persisting until you get it. Let me repeat my assertion number two. Faith means trusting God's good intentions and persisting in taking our concerns to Him. To illustrate what I mean, let me tell, you knew I was going to do this, I have another story to tell. This is the last story, though. If you don't like my stories, this is the last one. Okay. Once there was a father who had made great promises to his two sons concerning rich and fertile land that would one day be theirs. Before the day when that land could be theirs, however, the two sons both found themselves in need of $10,000 to help themselves, to help them out of a difficult situation. Although the father was loving and kind, he was also a father of discipline and temperance, and it was by no means certain that he would grant the money. The first son thought to himself, "My father has shown how much he loves me and cares for my future by the great promise he has made. Perhaps he will add to that promise and help me with my current trouble." But when he asked his father for the money, he received a noncommittal answer. He was content for a time, but his need pressed on him again, and so, remembering his father's love, he went to ask again. Each time that his need drove him to his father, he asked, hoping the answer would be yes, but knowing that the answer might be no. He always remembered, however, the great promise that his father had made, and that ultimately his father would make him rich. The last time he asked, the look in his father's eyes told him that the answer was a final no, and the son bowed his head in acceptance and went his way to deal with the problem another way. The second son thought to himself, "How can I get my father to give me this money? I think I have him all figured out. If I bombard him with constant requests, sooner or later he will have to give me what I want." So the second son went to the father again and again, just as the first son did, but all the time thinking that he had found a very effective technique to bend his father to his will. When it became clear to him that the father would not give him what he wanted, he went away cursing under his breath. Okay, so I've really loaded the dice, I know. But the first son in this story illustrates the assertion I'm making here. Even with those things that God has not promised to do for us, persistence in prayer can be an appropriate sign of faith. The first son asked because he was in need, and he asked because he knew that his father loved him. That's why he went. To pray when we are in trouble, even when the specific answer we want is not assured, can be a sign that we trust the God that we are praying to. I think we see this in some of the admonitions that we see in the Bible. Paul, for example, in Philippians says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." What is Paul getting at in this context? He is talking about a situation where anxiety and concern is driving people to do things that they shouldn't be doing. And he is encouraging them, rather, to remember the God that they're dealing with. Be anxious for nothing. Pray to God. Prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. Be grateful to God for what he is doing. Remember who he is. And ask him, in fact, to deal with those situations that are causing you anxiety. Now, Paul is not saying that God is certain to deal with the things that are causing you anxiety in the way that you would like. Sometimes God's answer is, no, you're going to stay in that situation. I am not going to take you out of it. Nonetheless, Paul is encouraging us to be anxious for nothing and to act on that lack of anxiety, to seek that lack of anxiety by turning to God, asking him for help, and being grateful to him for what we know in fact that he's doing. Whether he says yes or no, he is working for our benefit, and we have everything to be grateful for. Peter says a similar kind of thing in 1 Peter. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. Once again, the issue is, what attitude am I going to take towards God? How am I going to think of my situation? Peter says that I should humble myself under the hand of God. And that involves bowing and saying, I'm taking from you. I'm looking to you for the decision about what's going to happen here. Ultimately, with the confidence that he will exalt me at the proper time, someday God will raise me up. That is assured. But in the meantime, I am casting all my anxiety upon him because he cares for me. Now, the interesting thing is that Peter goes on, he makes it clear that the trials and pressures that we are under, the sufferings that we are going through, may last for some time. When I am casting all my anxiety upon him, he is not promising that by doing so, the pressures will go away. He makes it clear that the pressures, in fact, may stay. But I am casting all my anxiety on him now, in the midst of the pressures I face now, confident that he is on my side, asking him for his help as I think I need it, but recognizing that he knows best and that ultimately he will exalt me. I know in the end that God's intention is to raise me up high. And if he doesn't do it the way I think it ought to be done now, nonetheless, he will do it in the end. Neither of these passages promise that God will specifically give us the answer that we want. But they do assure us that God is the right one to turn to with our anxieties. So persistence in appealing for his help can be, therefore, an act of great faith. It can be a very appropriate thing to do. And we are encouraged to turn to God with all of our troubles, with all of our anxieties. This brings me to assertion number three. Faith means accepting that God may say no and not letting persistence become presumption. I say it one more time. Faith means accepting that God may say no and not letting persistence become presumption. This is the problem that the second son had. His persistence is not based on trust in the father's character. It's based on presumption, on the idea that he has a technique that will force the father's hand. And I have to say that at times, some of the teaching that we can hear out there on prayer about persistence and how God has to do what we ask him to if we only persist in asking and ask with total faith and so on, can actually become a very presumptuous thing. It actually depersonalizes God from my perspective. God is no longer a wise father who listens to our requests and then decides what is best for us. He has become, in the old phrase, the cosmic gumball machine, and our prayers are the quarter that we put in. We would feel gypped if we put in our quarter and we didn't get our gumball. So, likewise, we would feel gypped if we persist in prayer, confidently believing that we're going to get what we ask for, and we don't get what we're asked for. We have a right to it. That's the deal. Well, at best, that is a mistake, and at worst, that is presumption. This mistaken view of prayer sometimes makes a virtue of the fact that we will not take no for an answer. Well, going back to my first assertion, regarding the great gospel promises of God, that's a good attitude to take. We should not take no for an answer because God is not saying no. He is saying, I promise that the answer will finally be yes. But not taking no for an answer for all of the things that we might ask God for can also be the height of presumption. The great heroes of the faith in the Bible sometimes showed us that it is the faithful thing to do to take no for an answer. Now, it is not wrong to persist in prayer, and we see that as well in the lives of the people in the Bible. David prayed unendingly for the life of his son. Paul prayed 3 times for relief from the thorn in the flesh. Jesus prayed all night for deliverance from the cross. And these prayers, asking for these things and continuing to ask for those things, I think were a true expression and sign of their faith. This was good. And yet their faith was also shown in their willingness to accept the answer no. When David's son died, he got up and accepted the decision of God. Paul accepted God's explanation that God intended Paul to have a thorn in the flesh. That thorn was accomplishing God's purposes, and Paul accepted that. And Jesus gave us the very model of all such prayers in the garden when he said, "Not my will, but thine be done." Now, nobody is questioning the strength of Jesus' faith and the fervency of his desire for deliverance. He was sweating blood. This was a matter of great concern to him. Yet he deferred to the Father's will, even though it meant in the end he must go through agony. In the end, as the Bible tells us, his victory would not be by avoiding the cross, but by triumphing through it. Okay, so here's what I'm trying to get across this morning. The parables that I've been talking about for the last 2 weeks, The Friend at Midnight and The Unjust Judge, both have 2 essential elements, it seems to me. One, both concern asking God to keep his great promises. The Friend at Midnight is in the context of the Lord's Prayer and its request for the coming of the kingdom and the healing of our huge spiritual problems. The Unjust Judge is about the request for justice, for God to make everything right, which will only be fully realized when Jesus returns. These prayers are for things that God has committed himself to. He has promised to forgive us and rescue us from evil and bring his kingdom and make everything right. So that is one element of these parables. The prayer in view is prayer for those things that God has promised. The second element in those parables is the appropriateness of believing that God will keep his promises and continuing to turn to him. Persistence in prayer in this way is persistence in belief that God will do what he said he was going to do. But these two elements go together. I will not take no for an answer goes together with God has promised to do this. Those things must be married. The mistake is in thinking that I will not take no for an answer is the appropriate attitude for all our prayers. But that is not faith. At best, it is a misunderstanding, and at worst, it is arrogance. God wants us to trust him, and that means that we will take all our concerns to him. Faith, however, has several facets to it. Faith says, I know you will keep your promises. Faith says, there are other things I want as well, and because I trust you, I will take those desires to you. But in the end, faith has to say, not my will, but thine be done. Okay, well, I have a short message today. That was it. You just heard it. So let's take some time now for any comments or questions that you may have.
Could you talk about the relevance of an emotional state to faith? For instance, if I am asking God for something and I don't have an emotional sense of I trust him, I mean, I'm asking him, I know I should trust him and that kind of thing, but but the emotions are not there. In fact, I have a distinct emotional sense of not trusting him. That's my question.
I have an emotional sense that I don't trust him.
I couldn't honestly say, I know I am trusting God. Now, that could be from a number of different, coming from a number of different places, but it's my emotional state.
Well, I guess my answer would be is it's along the lines of what you said at the end there, is that emotional state could be coming from a number of different places. The fact is that the very reason that the Bible puts so much emphasis on the idea of testing our faith, of putting us in situations where we are confronted with the issue, do I really believe this, and am I willing to act on this, and that sort of thing, is because there is a very difficult and sometimes long process to move from the fundamental willingness, which is true in my heart, that I believe the gospel and I am willing to believe the truths that God is telling me, and actually experientially looking at something scary and saying, yeah, I trust God when it comes to that scary thing as well. So that process of our faith being tested in that way means that we're pretty much guaranteed that we are going to have those times when emotionally we are ambivalent, at least. I mean, we're wrestling with, I do trust God, but on the other hand, I'm scared and I know I shouldn't be, but I am, or, you know, or I'm worried or I'm upset and so on. So I think the picture that God paints in the Bible of what the agenda is, what he's doing for us in this life, not only does not suggest that I will be emotionally constant and always at a high state of feeling trusting and safe and in good shape, but I think it suggests the other, that in the rough and tumble of wrestling with the trials of life, that battle is going to be going on and those emotions are going to be very much a part of it. So now, can I say then that everyone who ever has that emotion has nothing to worry about? No, what I should worry about in that situation is, oh, I'm not a believer, but what I should worry about is, I am facing the question now, how am I going to respond in the midst of my present circumstances, and here is this is the battle that I have, is am I going to trust God here? But the fact that I'm wrestling, from my perspective, is pretty much guaranteed.
Should I concentrate on fixing my emotions?
Yeah, well, let me tell you how I answer that question. And I'm not sure that everybody answers this question the way I do. In fact, I'm fairly sure that not everybody does. But this is how I think about it. It seems to me that I can't really change my emotions. My emotions are a response that I have to my understanding of the world and the situation that I find myself in. So I think the place to do battle, this is what I believe, and I mean, this is just what I believe. This is what I do. This is how I live my life. And maybe I'm a fool for doing it this way, but this is what I do. When I am confronted with those kind of emotions, I don't try to talk myself out of the emotions. I try to deal with what is it that I'm afraid of? What is it that I'm thinking or believing that's leading to this emotional state? And I try to deal with that. You know, that's not true. You know, I have reason not to feel this way. And then the hope is that ultimately, as I come to be more solidly grounded in my picture of my world and my understanding of who God is, and I don't mean in an abstract sort of, I could write a list of God's qualities or something like that, but I mean as I personally am coming to invest myself in the reliability of God and so on, then my emotions sort of come along behind. So actually, although those sorts of emotions can be very troubling, and I don't like them, I don't use my emotional state as a gauge of my spiritual state. I don't think it's a reliable gauge. It just tells me it tells me that something's going on, and the question is, what is it? And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, this is an old analogy, but I think it's true. It's kind of like pain as an indicator that, you know, I've got a splinter in my finger or something like that. I could try to deaden my nerves so that I do not feel the pain, but probably a more profitable way of dealing with it is to deal with the splinter. And that's kind of how I think about it. So.
Could you comment on what particular version you prefer, what translation you prefer for, especially verses 6 through 8?
Of?
Oh, chapter 18 in Luke.
Okay. Read what those verses say in the translation that you have in front of you there.
I have about 8 translations in front of me.
Okay, we'll pick a couple of good ones.
Okay. All right. One of the ones that I have a question about is, this is the New King James Version. Okay. Then the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge said. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on earth?" And then I'll go to, hey, let's go to the Message. That's fun. I don't think they have verses in the Message, actually.
I won't say a word.
How about New Living? That's better.
Okay.
Then the Lord said, "Learn a lesson from this evil judge. Even he rendered a just decision in the end, so don't you think God will surely give justice to his chosen people who plead with him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he'll grant justice to them quickly. But when I, the Son of Man, return, how many will I find who have faith?" Another one, like the various different translations present a different degrees of urgency as to like how, like from the New King James Version, I get the idea that God might bear long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the other one seems like, oh no, he's going to hook you up. He's going to do it right now.
Right. Okay. Yeah. In teaching on the parable last week, I talked about that phrase. To my mind, it's difficult to be decisive about what it's saying there, and I don't think it changes that much in the overall message, so I haven't worried too much about it. In The Friend at Midnight, the translation decisions we have to make there are absolutely determinative of how we understand what the point is. In this case, there are several places where we have to make decisions, but no matter how you make those decisions, the point comes out roughly the same, I think, so it's not as important. But one of the questions here is whether this is an assertion or a question that is expecting the answer no. It's like that though he delays or though he is patient with them or whatever it was that it said. That's one way to go there, that Jesus is saying, isn't he going to grant justice for them even though he may delay for a while? You know, that's one way to understand it. And then he comes along and says he will give justice to them speedily. And then the question is, how do I fit speedily with him saying that he's going to wait a while? Or you can take it more as being a question, like the first one, shall he not grant their request for justice? And will he delay long over them? No, of course not. I mean, that, and then the expected answer is no, he won't. So one of them is saying, yes, he will delay. And one of them is saying, no, he won't delay. And in the end, it doesn't make that much difference because in this story, there is an element of delay and an element of speed. And it just depends which way you take that translation as to which of those things it's emphasizing. But I see the resolution of those things I was talking about last week in Habakkuk 2:3, where God tells Habakkuk that this vision is coming, wait for it. And then he says, though it tarries, wait for it, it will not delay, something like that. The idea that somehow, on the other hand, you're going to feel like you're waiting for it, you're going to want it and it's not there, and yet, on the other hand, it will not delay. It is coming, and God is not being coy about this. It is on its way, and it will arrive, certainly. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at here, is that on the one hand, we have this sense that we're crying out and nothing's being done. So we have to deal with the delay just the way the widow had to deal with the delay of in the judge who kept saying no. It seems to us like God keeps saying no because things still go on the way they always have. But on the other hand, God will grant their request for justice speedily. He will, in fact, he knows that he has made this promise and it is going to be done. So that's how I would deal with that.
Well, I was just going to comment on and ask a question about your response to Margaret. It seems to me like when any of us comes up to that junction of I believe, but help me with my unbelief kind of thing, where I might have an emotional experience of, gosh, I see the way I'm not really trusting here, and it might even be frightening to me that that I'm not seeing my own faith. But it strikes me that from what you're saying, that these, what Jesus is saying, is that that is the very prayer that I can be, that I'm promised will be answered. Right. When I hit that spot and ask God to grant me that faith, to hang on to me, to get me through this time when I might see my own heart as turning cold or bitter or faithless or whatever, that, I mean, it's an incredible promise, really, when it comes right down to it, and it's so encouraging that it isn't, I mean, I'm the one sitting there at that juncture making that decision to pray, and I need to do that on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm doing that because God is hanging on to me. And that's the very promise that I've really appreciated the series for
right.
that.
Right.
It's really encouraging.
Right. No, that's very good. No, that's a very good addition to what I said to Margaret, because that's exactly right. I should say that is one of the great sources of comfort to me personally in those kinds of situations, is that sense that, you know, the state I am in right now, God, I don't seem to be able to do anything about it. I don't even know how to begin to do anything about where I am right now. But my confidence is that you can deal with me in a way that I can't deal with myself. And so that takes a lot of the sting out of that sense of, boy, am I a mess, because God deals with messes, and that's part of the promise. Yeah, that's good. And in your comment, I am reminded that in that parable itself, Jesus' description of God's elect crying out to him day and night, I think it resonates with the picture from the Old Testament that you see in the Psalms and the prophets, that constant, how long, O Lord? And when you look at those statements in Psalms and the prophets and those kind of places, those are not people in a state of emotional equilibrium when they're making those. I mean, they are upset, and they're telling God off because what are you doing? And yet it always comes back in the end, yet I know you're going to do what you said and I trust you. So that emotional disequilibrium is a part of the process, I think.
I'll just make a comment and you can yay or nay respond to it. It seems to me one of the significant things about these passages, and maybe you've already talked about this, but I think I was accustomed to thinking of prayer as a spiritual discipline, as I think is pretty common. So when you come across the virtue of persistence in prayer, the idea is that you persist in discipline, that you persist in a particular
right.
disciplined approach to life. What's interesting about these passages, or especially the one about the unjust judge, is the link between faith and prayer.
Yes,
that it really does understand prayer to be a spontaneous act emerging from faith, not a discipline we engage in for the sake of discipline. So it seems to me these passages, or that passage in particular, really cuts across some of the underlying foundational assumptions that we have about prayer.
Right.
Then just on an unrelated note, back to Margaret's question, it seems to me that faith is never a question of how you feel, but it's a question of how you choose and how you act. That's always presented to us as the measure of our faith, is what we do, not how we feel about it.
Well, let me go to your first point first. Yeah, I hinted at that a little bit in what I said here today, but I didn't make a big deal out of it. But yeah, the idea is the kind of persistence that we're talking about here is that decision, I am not going to abandon my trust in God. The pressure is on, and if he doesn't do anything this time, I'm out of here. That's the kind of issue that we're facing, and I can't schedule that. That is, I could be persistent in a discipline of prayer, but I'm going to face the same issue. I mean, I can go along 364 days in the year with my disciplined prayer, but it's that 365th day when the pressure is on and I have to decide, am I going to stick with God or not? That's where the real issue of persistence is coming in. Having said that, as we look at the issue of prayer, although I am not, I mean, everybody knows I am not a very religious person, and I tend to de-emphasize the spiritual discipline aspect of this, in theory, we do have to recognize that there are prayers that we will pray that are not always spontaneous, like up in front of a group, you know, we're going to pray together. You know, I don't want to put Bob under any pressure, but it's entirely possible that not every single prayer that Bob has prayed up here, you know, has been a spontaneous outpouring of a deep commitment to God that has come upon him in the moment. I mean, he made this decision, we're going to pray. It's good for us to ask God for these things. It's good for us to remind each other that prayer to God is an appropriate thing. And if there's a certain amount of superficiality to it, still it's okay to do. So it's not that every prayer has to justify itself as being a crisis of faith or something like that. But I think you're right. What happens is, and this is key to what you're saying, Jack, and what I absolutely agree with you about, is we take the urgency of these sorts of things, I mean, like the admonition to keep on praying at the beginning of the parable of the unjust judge in Luke 18, and we take that and we say, oh, that means I need to have a discipline of prayer every day. The urgency, keep on praying, is not about that. Now, if you want to argue that a discipline of prayer is an appropriate thing to do as a Christian, we can have that discussion, but not because Jesus said to keep on praying in Luke 18. That's the key, is I don't want to confuse my categories here. Just like I don't want to take the assurance, the answer will be yes, and apply it to any question that I might want to ask. I have to understand what's being talked about. And when it comes to your second one, yes, in a way, I absolutely agree with that. I find that a complicated way to talk about things, though. I mean, that issue is complicated. When Paul says, be anxious for nothing, he is encouraging us to make a decision about how we are going to relate to God. And I agree with that. I think what he is saying is, commit yourself to that picture of God that will lead you to have less anxiety because you understand the God that you're dealing with, or something like that.
But is it less stress? See, that it seems to me the distinction we need to make is between anxiety and stress, because we blur that distinction. And so whenever we experience stress, some kind of emotional volatility of some kind, we will often say, well, I'm being anxious, as if that's some sort of mark of lack of faith. And I don't think that can be right, because Jesus was stressed out of his mind in Gethsemane, but I don't think he lacked faith.
Right, right. No, well, but that's part of what I mean by it's being complicated. If somebody heard what you're saying there, and you said, it's not our emotions, it's our faith, what do we mean by emotions? I mean, yeah, if you want to, so you're taking the concept of anxiety and kind of straining out just this almost physical component of this discomfort that comes on me in a difficult situation. Yeah, anxiety is more like, oh my gosh, I don't know if things are going to be okay for me. And Paul is urging us to remember that, in fact, if I've put my trust in God, things will be okay for me. So that's what I mean. I am a little leery of a statement like the way you made it, just because it depends on how you define emotions and what's going on. But if you define them rightly, I think that's right. What you're saying is that's correct. I mean, what I'm and that's what I'm getting at, is that ultimately I think even that there can be a sense in which what you're calling stress in that situation can become less if my perception of my situation has changed. But that's not ultimately my business. I think we're in agreement about that. That's not my job, is to lower my sense of stress. It is to believe what is true and act on what I think is true and let my emotional state trail along and fit what I am learning to seat. So, yeah. Anyone else?
I have so many things I'm thinking about, so it's hard for me to just say one thing. But like we keep on asking about like prayer as the idea of asking God for things. But what about just like to me? I don't really see necessarily that prayer is always that. Like, because I mean, it seems to me like what about the whole aspect of like a relationship with God? Like, I mean, yeah, it's not just about coming to Him and asking Him for things. It's just about talking to Him like He's like we're in communion with Him, you know, like, and I don't know, I just opened and read this verse about, like Jesus, like, crying out, like, can you save me from death, and what you were talking about earlier, and it's just interesting, because it just says that, like, Jesus cried out, and then He was heard because of His reverent submission, and I just think that's really interesting, because it's like, it didn't say, like, anything about like, oh, He wasn't answered and God did this anyway. It's like He was heard, you know, and to me that's like in our pain and suffering that we're heard and that we're comforted because we have the greatest comforter in all the earth. Like, it's not just about like, oh, I'm asking God for this or that. It's about, I don't know, like He died for us and He can comfort us in that time of need, you know. So I don't know, I just thought I'd bring that up and say it was on my mind.
Oh, sure. Well, no, you're absolutely right. It's not my intention to say that prayer is only about asking for things, mm-hmm. but the topic that we've been talking about, that I'm talking about, is about asking for things because these two parables are both assurances that if you ask for these things, you'll get them. Mm-hmm. So my concern here is to talk about the ways in which we have, as Christians, have, when we think about what they call petitionary prayer, those prayers where I'm actually asking God for something, what is the Bible promising me? How should I think about what I'm doing there? So you're right. There's much more to prayer than just asking for stuff. But the Bible does have a fair amount to say about how we should think about asking for things. And that's the arena I'm looking at. But you're right. That's not at all the extent of it. Okay. Well, was it anyone else? Oh, okay. Well, this will be the last one.
Fairly recently, I came to the conclusion that one of my problems with my emotional state has to do not so much with not trusting God specifically. For instance, if God were to come to me, show up to me, and promise me, Margaret, something, I really don't think I'd have any problem saying, cool, it's going to happen. The problem I have is thinking, wondering, believing that God's promises apply to me. And I'm not sure where that's coming from, because if I had come from an abusive background or whatever, it would make a lot of sense that I'd have trouble believing myself to be lovable and that kind of thing. So I don't really know where that's coming from. It might just be a human thing. But I think that it wouldn't surprise me if people had grown up in situations where the people who should have loved them didn't love them, that it would be unbelievable to them. You know, they would say, cool, you know, God, if God made a promise to me, I would believe it, but I don't know if He's made that promise to me, and it doesn't make sense to me that He would make such a promise to me because I'm not lovable. So I was just wondering if you had any comments about that.
I know that that problem is a difficult one to deal with when people are in that spot. It is not easy to find the way out. And I'm not sure. I don't know the landscape well enough to lay down the markers and say, this is the way you get out of that spot. I know things that seem to me to be very important. To ask the question, did God choose me, is too abstract, I think, a question to deal with. But I can look at, does God save people like me? And the question is, even if it were true that I am unlovable, that I have this, the way I feel, which is not true, but even if it were true, that's still the kind of people that God set out to save. It's the lost sheep. It's the one who wanders away from the fold that he's interested in. And so to continually remind myself that it is God's rescue for the unworthy that we're really talking about here, I think can be helpful. And then to recognize that as well, that those who in the end God does not save are not the ones who are longing for God to save them. They're ones who say, oh, that's interesting for you, but I have other things, and they wander off and do those instead. So the combination of God rescues the unworthy and I really want him to rescue me should be, if that isn't speaking to me, then I can deal with, okay, there's something going on that those truths which ought to really resonate with me are not doing that, and I can try to deal with that. But that's the best answer I would know how to give. Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you.